This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, July 12, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. Federal judges often defer to the executive when it comes to assertions of national security and presidential prerogatives. Where does Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh come down on those issues? Gene Healy, a vice president at the Cato Institute, comments. Courts tend to defer to presidents on national security matters, and lower courts take their marching orders, it seems, from the Supreme Court, which is fairly deferential. What does that mean in terms of the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court?
Well, he's got an enormously long paper trail. He's been an appellate judge for 12 years. He's written nearly 300 opinions. In many cases, those opinions will be governed to some extent by controlling precedent. So there, you know, it's possible that some of these things may be taken out of context. And that's one concern that apparently Mitch McConnell has expressed with nominating a judge with an extensive paper trail.
With respect to presidential power, Brett Kavanaugh has some pretty unique experience. And that experience has led him to say that, you know, during a president's term, maybe we should shield that person from investigations or some sort of some direct questioning related to investigations.
Well, I think he does. He does have a long track record of involvement in the executive branch. He's been compared to somebody compared him to Zelig from the Woody Allen movie. He's shown up in just about every conservative cause in the last quarter century. So he worked for the Independent Counsel's Office under Ken Starr during the Clinton impeachment. Helped write the Starr report for Congress. He was involved in the Elian Gonzalez case in the early 2000s. He served in the Bush administration, two stints, one as a lawyer in the White House counsel's office, another as staff secretary. And so he's got an abundance of experience. In many ways, he's right out of Federalist Society central casting. And for libertarians, you know, that can be a mixed bag, especially when it comes to executive power. On the plus side, there's every indication that he tends to be skeptical of regulatory overreach by administrative agencies. On the minus side, there are indications that he may be less skeptical of executive overreach when it comes to presidential power.
So what of the reasons for skepticism with regard to presidential power?
Well, you asked about the idea of supporting immunity for prosecution for sitting presidents. I'm some of the folks in the Democratic Party may be making a little too much of this. It's based on two law review articles he wrote over the space of 10 years, one in 1998, one in 2009. And that's where they're getting this idea of this insinuation that he might be inclined to protect Trump from the Mueller investigation. I've looked at both of these law review articles, and they're mainly policy arguments, so less constitutional arguments. And they're interesting. I think they show at least how his thinking has evolved on the sort of privileges and immunities for sitting presidents. The first one that he wrote in 1998 for the Georgetown Law Journal, shortly after he left Ken Starr's office, it does say that special counsels and outside prosecutors are sometimes necessary. And what he proposes is a number of statutory reforms that he he supported Congress passing to make outside investigations more streamlined and more efficient when they are necessary, and maybe less likely when they're not necessary. So in this article from 98, he talks about, instead of the then independent counsel statute, where the independent counsel is appointed by the attorney general in a three-judge panel, he wants a statute that says the independent counsel will be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. He also supports a change to the law providing that the president is temporarily immune to criminal indictment and prosecution while he's in office. He says correctly, I think, that whether a sitting president can be criminally prosecuted while he's in office is an open constitutional question. One thing that's interesting, the third reform that he proposes by statute in this article is a statute that would say that the president may not maintain any executive privilege other than a national security privilege in response to a grand jury or criminal trial subpoena sought by the United States. So in this proposal from 1998, Kavanaugh is really by statute, you know, inviting Congress to allow the president to shut down some of the dubious claims of privilege that he'd seen made during the Clinton impeachment. This would be something that would actually enhance the ability to investigate the president. But over the next 10 years, after some service in the Bush administration, it does seem, when you turn to the article he wrote in 2009 covering similar subjects, it seems like his thinking has changed. He's come to a wider view of the privileges and protections that sitting presidents ought to enjoy. For one thing, he writes that, I believe that the president should be excused from some of the burdens of ordinary citizenship while serving in office. And one of those burdens apparently is a criminal investigation. So in 2009, this is all proposals for laws that Congress should pass. They're not it's not anything that he's saying is inherent in the Constitution. So I don't think we can extrapolate directly to how he'd rule in any of these sorts of cases as a justice on the Supreme Court. But in 2009, he broadens his original proposal for presidential immunity. In 98, it was temporary immunity from criminal prosecution combined with a restriction on certain executive privilege claims. By 2009, it seems to include immunity from questioning. It says Congress might consider a law exempting a president while in office from criminal prosecution and investigation, including from criminal prosecutors or defense counsel. So this is broad, and it's odd a little bit because by all accounts, when he was working for independent counsel Ken Starr, he was among the most zealous of the staffers in pushing the envelope on questioning the president. He wanted to grill Bill Clinton about where else besides the blue dress that Clinton left his mark. And, you know, 10 years later, by 2009, you really see that he's developed some concerns about allegedly unreasonable burdens on the presidency.
So some of that may just be frustration with what he understands to be perfectly constitutional and legal behavior among those who may be investigating the president.
It happens after the service throughout much of the George W. Bush administration. I don't think you can. Since the article came out in 2009, when you have a Democratic president, I don't think you can say that it's a partisan shift. We tend to nominate for the Supreme Court and for the federal appellate courts a lot of people that have extensive executive branch experience, and that tends to give them, whether they've served as prosecutors or in the Office of Legal Counsel, Solicitor General's office. It tends to give them a broad institutional favoritism towards the executive branch. That may have some impact on – that certainly seems to have some impact on how Kavanaugh's views evolved and may have some impact on how justices view these sorts of separation of powers cases.
Now, you mentioned – we talked a little bit about the national security claims. And one thing that is particularly concerning about the Supreme Court in general is how it deals with the issue of data collection by the National Security Agency. Kavanaugh heard the case of Clayman v. Obama that dealt with metadata, and he found it to be perfectly reasonable and constitutional.
Yeah, in fact, he went out of his way a bit to express that view. So Clayman versus Obama is a challenge to the NSA's domestic bulk collection of call records, something that came out, one of the revelations from Edward Snowden in 2013. The district court judge had ruled that it likely violated the Fourth Amendment. And on appeal, 2015, the D.C. Circuit denies a rehearing, and Kavanaugh is on the panel. The only opinion in the case is his concurrence to the denial of rehearing en banc, which where he writes separately. He's the only one who writes to assert his view that the government's metadata collection program is entirely consistent with the Fourth Amendment. He says, first of all, that the collection of the plaintiff's call records wasn't a search within the meaning of that amendment. He refers to the Smith versus Maryland case about pen registers involving a single criminal suspect. And Kavanaugh says that, and even if it was a search, it was entirely reasonable because, quote, the government's program for bulk collection of telephony metadata serves a critically important special need, preventing terrorist attacks on the United States, which it was never shown to do, incidentally. This goes back to the question of controlling precedent. I mean, Kavanaugh and Kavanaugh's defenders might argue that Smith versus Maryland was the controlling precedent at this time. The Carpenter case at the Supreme Court in 2018 hadn't been decided yet. That case really cut the other way. It said that cell site location data is a Fourth Amendment search. And so Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, of course, wrote a dissent in that case, but it's a dissent arguing that for much broader protection and a rethinking of the Fourth Amendment's application to cell phone, to the whole digital world, more or less. It's pretty clear from the concurrence that he wrote in Clayman versus Obama that Kavanaugh doesn't share those concerns that Gorsuch expressed. You've heard the phrase that's on Twitter, "but Gorsuch." You know, there's the idea that whatever else you get out of Trump, you've got a qualified and excellent Supreme Court justice in Neil Gorsuch. At least when it comes to Fourth Amendment and its application in the 21st century, the hashtag here might be for Kavanaugh might be not Gorsuch, and that it seems to me it ought to have some bearing on how excited libertarians should get about this particular nomination.
Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.